From Philadelphia, it's Torah Talk. Hello everyone, I'm Michael Karasik, and this week we are reading Parshat Ki Teitzeh, Deuteronomy 21:10 to 25:19. That's the end of Deuteronomy 25. And here's the passage that I'm about to read to you that we'll discuss on the podcast today, mostly not because of its content, but because of one of the words in it, because this is a podcast about lexicography. So starting in Deuteronomy 22, verse 23, the case of a virgin who is engaged to a man. If a man comes upon her in town and lies with her, you shall take the two of them out to the gate of that town and stone them to death. The girl, because she did not cry for help in the town, and the man, because he violated another man's wife. Thus you will sweep away evil from your midst. I should point out the girl is a na'ara, the man is an ish. She is not an isha here, but a na'ara. So you may not like that, but it's the Bible's language, not that of the translation. Okay, resuming with verse 25, but if the man comes upon the engaged girl in the open country, and the man lies with her by force, only the man who lay with her shall die. But you should do nothing to the girl. The girl did not incur the death penalty, for this case is like that of a man attacking another and murdering him. He came upon her in the open. Though the engaged girl cried for help, there was no one to save her. If a man comes upon a virgin who is not engaged, and he seizes her and lies with her, and they are discovered, the man who lay with her shall pay the girl's father 50 shekels of silver, and she shall be his wife. Because he has violated her, he can never have the right to divorce her. So I'm not saying the content here is not interesting from all kinds of legal and social aspects, but what we're going to talk about primarily is this word ina. He violated her. The root is ayin nun he. The binyan is piel. What does this root mean? We're going to talk lots more about this, but really not until the end of the podcast. I do, however, have to give you at least two alternate translations that I found of this word ina, this verb ina, which is violated in the JPS translation. In the King James, it is humbled. He humbled the other man's wife, or because he humbled her, he cannot have the right to divorce her. And Robert Alter's translation, abused her, or abused another man's wife. Again, we'll talk much more about that shortly. First, some comments on the laws. First of all, here's Bernie Levinson in the Jewish Study Bible. As in Exodus 22:15, the intercourse in verse 29 does not constitute adultery because the woman is neither married nor betrothed. In contrast to Exodus 22:16, however, the payment to the father does not directly represent compensation for the loss of the bride price, which is normally a negotiated amount. See Genesis 34:12, and we will talk about Genesis 34 again before we're done as well. As a fixed amount externally imposed by the law, the payment here seems closer to a fine. Both Deuteronomy and Exodus require the man now also legally and contractually to marry the woman by paying the bride price to the father. In contrast to Exodus 22:16, the father's consent is not sought, and therefore he must negotiate the bride price with the man who had intercourse with his daughter and no other. Thus the fine paid by the man seems intended to compensate the father for diminished potential earnings had he been able to negotiate a higher bride price with another man. Post-biblical Jewish law granted both the father and the daughter the right to refuse such marriages. See Maimonides. So what are the laws in that much briefer section in Exodus 22, Parshat Mishpatim, the covenant code, as Bible scholars call it? If a man seduces a virgin for whom the bride price has not been paid and lies with her, he must make her his wife by payment of a bride price. If her father refuses to give her to him, he must still weigh out silver in accordance with the bride price for virgins. So what he does with her, he lies with her, that's pretty straightforward. What he's doing here is not inah, but yifateh pei taf hei, also in the PL. Nachum Serna explains, seduces, the English translation of JPS, by persuasion, that's what Rashi says, or deception, that's what Nachmanides says, but not by coercion. There's a presumption of consent on the part of the girl for the law of rape. See Deuteronomy 22:22-29, which we read at the beginning of the podcast. Here's William Propp in the Anchor Bible commentary to Exodus on the law from the Covenant Code 22:15-16. His comment on the word seduces. Like other ancient peoples, the Israelites probably lacked our clear distinctions between elopement, abduction, and rape. Even English rape originally referred to stealing a woman. That rape comes from the Latin verb meaning to seize, if I understand correctly. Originally referred to stealing a woman from her male relatives. In Exodus 22, abduction slash rape is classified as an example of theft, specifically of borrowing property and not returning it intact. Violence need not be involved. Since the root pei taf yud, PTY, refers to taking advantage of another's simplicity, our law can refer to a consensual situation, presumably including a false promise of marriage. And as Rashi's grandson Rashbam points out, if the bride price has been paid, then according to Deuteronomy 22:24, that's our verse, he is subject to stoning because now she is a woman who belongs to another man. And that's on the handout just to point out to you, to remind you that the traditional commentators are going to try to reconcile all of these laws and make sense out of them. Here's Jeff Tige going back to our Deuteronomy verse now, as Rashbam has pointed us. Jeff Tige in the JPS Torah commentary says it's not clear why Deuteronomy deals with the possibility of rape in 23-25 only in the case of engaged and unmarried girls. So the engaged girl is in verse 29. Unquestionably, evidence that a married woman was raped would clear her too, as the halacha rules. And the point of his comment is taking for granted that this word that JPS translates as violated, King James as humbled, and Alter as abused, Tige is understanding this verb to mean rape in the contemporary English meaning of that word. That's why Genesis 34 is on the table, because was Dinah, Jacob's daughter, raped by Shechem, as many people have been taught for many centuries? Or did he sleep with her and she was quite willing, but it was a situation that was not acceptable to her family? And that's the question on the table here, not what the law should decide, but what does that verb really mean? Nachmanides says in verse 24, because he violated another man's wife, ina, another man's wife, only rape is called violation. Here, though he seizes her by force, she is nonetheless considered willing because she might have saved herself from him by crying out. The man is still considered to have violated her because he did not attempt to seduce her. He just grabbed her. How does Nachmanides know that? Because Nachmanides understands the verb ina to mean rape. Ibn Ezra, the frenemy of Nachmanides, says, or rather, Nachmanides is the frenemy of Ibn Ezra. It's not really a mutual relationship, because Nachmanides lived later. Ibn Ezra says in his comment on verse 28, if a man comes upon a virgin who is not engaged and he seizes her and lies with her, this paragraph refers specifically to rape, not to seduction, because Ibn Ezra does not think the verb ina means rape. Ibn Ezra says, look at verse 28 that says, he seizes her. The Hebrew verb is tafas. He grabs her. He catches her and grabs her. Now I turn to an article by my teacher, Meir Gruber, in a Festschrift for Menachem Cohen, the editor of the Mikra Ot Gedolot series from Bar Ilan University, HaKeter. This came out in 2005, and the English title of this Hebrew article is Nuances of the Verb Ina, meaning to fructify. And here's the English abstract to this Hebrew article. The idea, previously challenged, among others, by Weinfeld, Diem, Gruber's himself, of course, Frisch, and Chacham, that when the verb ina refers to sexual relations, it must perforce refer to rape, is a totally forced interpretation. That's why he challenged it. He and Weinfeld and Diem and Frisch and Chacham, I don't really know. Ariella Diem taught at Brandeis and died very, very young before I got there. Moshe Weinfeld was a teacher of Meir Gruber, famous for his book Deuteronomy and the Deuteronomic School, and you can read his discussion of this in English there on page 286. But here's what Meir Gruber says. In Deuteronomy 22:24, in fact, the verb ina refers to consensual sexual relations. And in his Hebrew article, he actually uses the English term. He points to the fact that we now have a law called statutory rape, where the girl was perfectly willing. She wasn't raped violently. She was perfectly willing and agreed to have sex with the guy, but she was so young that the law announces that she cannot legally consent, and so it's rape according to the statute, even though it's not physical rape in the world, so to speak. And he created, to discuss Deuteronomy 22:24, a term, again using the English words in his Hebrew article, statutory consent. That is, if you think, as Nachmanides does, that ina must mean that she was raped, violated, why are you stoning her to death? Because of what Meir Gruber is sarcastically dubbed statutory consent. She did not cry for help. She was in town where someone would have heard her scream, and she didn't scream. So that's statutory consent, even though Inah, according to Nachmanides and many contemporary scholars as well, must mean rape. But, says Mayer Gruber, the forced interpretation of Inah as rape does not accord with Ezekiel 22:7-12. The largely untapped legacy of medieval Jewish biblical lexicography can liberate biblical philology from the restrictions imposed by the reticence of 19th century lexicographers to recognize homonyms in biblical Hebrew. And I'm partly talking here now about what my students do. When you ask them what the biblical Hebrew word means, they tell you an English word, and I say, how do you know that? They looked it up in the dictionary. This is a root that in Brown, Driver, and Briggs, the traditional dictionary, and the Hebrew and Aramaic lexicon of the Old Testament that I quote on the podcast a lot, has four separate different roots with four separate different meanings. You can see them on the handout. If you go back to the Middle Ages or the early Middle Ages with the dictionary of Menachem Ibn Saruk that Rashi relied on, you can see he has, if I'm remembering correctly now, 17 different versions of this root, ayin, nun. The hay is not necessarily part of it for him. And there happens to be a modern biblical Hebrew dictionary that loves multiplying homonyms in a way that some of the other scholars, medieval and modern, don't. The Dictionary of Classical Hebrew, and I have on the handout by them 13 different roots, individual separate roots, ayin, nun, hey. The entries for all of these things are quite long, but they think that there are actually 13 different roots that ended up in modern Hebrew in biblical Hebrew with just those three consonants, number 13 of which means, as Mayer Gruber argues in his Hebrew article, and as Weinfeld argues in English on page 286 of Deuteronomy and the Deuteronomic School, to have intercourse. You may think it matters only to scholars of comparative Semitics whether there really were 13 separate homonyms of ayin, nun, hey. But it matters a lot for anyone who wants to understand the Bible whether one of those homonyms of ayin, nun, hey really was a verb that just meant not to rape, not to violate, not to humble or abuse, but just to have sex, or as Mayer Gruber says in the English title of his article, to fructify. I will let you decide whether you think that is correct or not. I'll be back with you next week for Parshat Ki Tavo. Until then, this is Michael Karasik saying thank you for listening.